Welcome to The Wildlife, a program that probes the mysteries of the animal world through interviews with scientists and other wildlife investigators. I'm Laurel Nemi, your host for The Wildlife, and also author of Animal Investigators, How the World's First Wildlife Forensic Lab is Solving Crimes and Saving Endangered Species. Today on The Wildlife, I'll be joined by Anna Nicaras, an expert on nocturnal primates and Asia's slow and slender lorises in particular. We'll talk about what makes these creatures so special and why they're sought after both as pets and as a key ingredient in traditional medicine. But first, let me play you today's creature call. This week's creature call is the sound from a nocturnal primate. Now listen carefully and see if you can guess what it is. At the end of the show, I'll play these sounds again and tell you what kind of animals made them. Now, let me turn to my conversation with Anna Nicaras, an expert on nocturnal primates and Asia's slow and slender lorises in particular. Anna Nicaras is a reader and course tutor in primate conservation at Oxford Brookes University in the United Kingdom. She is also a member of the IUCN Primate Specialist Group, the Conservation Working Party of the Primate Society of Great Britain, and on the Editorial Board of Endangered Species Research and Folia Primatologica. Anna's main research interests fall under the areas of conservation, ecology, and speciation. To study various aspects of these fields, her fieldwork has taken her to Trinidad, Senegal, Utah, India, Sri Lanka, Singapore, Indonesia, Uganda, and Kenya. Although she has conducted fieldwork on bats, small carnivores including civets and cats, mouse deer, and giant squirrels, her primary research focus is on primates. Anna has conducted many long-term studies of Indian and Sri Lankan slender lorises. Amongst others, her research topics have included behavioral ecology, life history, and foraging behavior. She has also looked at the community ecology of Sri Lanka's rainforest primates, including toque macaques and purple-faced leaf monkeys. In particular, she has examined the effects of fragmentation on populations throughout Sri Lanka's sparse remaining rainforest. Her current research project looks at the diversity and conservation of Asian slow lorises, both in the field, in the wildlife trade, and using museum specimens. This project is being undertaken by Anna and postgraduate students in Java, Sumatra, Thailand, Cambodia, Laos, Singapore, and Malaysia, where at least 5 species of slow loris are found. Morphological, behavioral, and vocal analyses are being used to uncover diversity within this group. Today we'll talk about what makes slender and slow lorises so special. They're extremely cute, with huge eyes that help them see at night. Did you know that the Ewoks in Star Wars films, you know those lovable furry creatures, were modeled after slow lorises? But unlike the Ewoks, lorises can't jump or leap. That means all of their movement has to be across branches that are connected to each other, and that makes an intact forest vital to their survival. Lorises are also interesting because they're one of the only venomous primates. They have a form of biological venom that's produced by a gland in their elbows, which they mix with saliva to create a powerful toxin. All of these animals' unique characteristics make them a sought-after ingredient in traditional medicine across Asia. In fact, Anna and her research team recently completed the first major study of the use of lorises in traditional medicine in Asia and found a multitude of uses. As a tonic for women after childbirth, for stomach problems, for healing wounds and broken bones, and in the treatment of sexually transmitted diseases. Lorises are seen as an animal with 100 uses, sort of like an aspirin in Western medicine. When we spoke recently, I asked Anna how she first got interested in primates.
I was studying biological anthropology for my undergraduate degree, and I was always interested in animals, and I had an idea to be a vet. And a veterinarian, but I didn't like the idea of surgery on animals. I was more interested in their bones than their flesh. And so when I took biological anthropology as a subject at university, I was completely drawn in. And the idea that I could study primates for a living was really appealing. And so I went immediately from getting interested in primates to looking at the ones we knew very little about. And I realized in all my textbooks, there was hardly anything ever mentioned about nocturnal primates, which are about 45% of living primate species. So I immediately started searching for nocturnal primates that I could study.
And so what are the nocturnal primates? Because we probably haven't heard of many of them.
Well, nocturnal primates, as the name implies, are ones that live at night. And they are mainly restricted to the Old World, which is Asia and Africa, and the island of Madagascar, which is off the coast of southeastern Africa. And they also, there's a very small number of nocturnal primates in the New World in South America, and those are called night monkeys, owl monkeys, or doracoolies. And so those are the only nocturnal monkeys. And we have a difference between monkeys and other types of primates, which popularly are known as prosimians, which means they evolved a bit earlier than the monkeys. And amongst the prosimians, you get day-living or diurnal ones, and night-living or nocturnal ones. And those nocturnal ones are found in Africa, and they are the bush babies, the pottos, and the angwantibos. They're found in Madagascar. Those are the lemurs, which have many different kinds. And they're found in Asia, which are the lorises and the tarsiers.
So tell me, when did you start getting interested in lorises? Or it was sort of early as you got interested in the nocturnal primates?
Well, I was doing my undergraduate degree in the early 90s. And at that time, not only were there very few nocturnal primates mentioned in the textbooks, it was mainly the lemurs. And so I initially thought I might study lemurs, and in 1993, I went to a big conference at Duke University,
And they have the Primate Center at Duke University.
Yes, it's actually now called the Duke Lemur Center because they specialize in these strange prosimian animals, and they have lorises, and they have lemurs, and they have bush babies, and I met a couple of scientists at that time who said, well, you should study lorises or bush babies, because we know almost nothing about those, whereas we at least know a little bit about lemurs. And also the idea in biology is if you want to get a job, it's a great idea to study nothing we know, something we know nothing about. So I chose the bush babies, and I went off to West Africa as an extremely, what do I want to say, like a devoted vegetarian. And I found I couldn't eat anything. So I was really hungry and I'm really miserable and seeing bushmeat all around me. So as soon as I got to choose a PhD project, I chose India instead and worked on one of the two types of lorises, which are called slender lorises. So that was the route. It was all a food choice, really.
Well, that makes sense. Tell me more about lorises. What makes a loris a loris, I guess?
Lorises are, there are two types of them, and in a way there are four types, because there are loris-like things in Africa, which are pottos and angwantibos. But a loris, the Asian ones, which are the true lorises, there are two forms, a slow one and a slender one. And basically, they are a small primate, less than 2 kilograms, and as small as about 120 grams, and they lack a tail. They only have a tiny little stub of a tail, a bit like a hamster. They have really long limbs, and they have other characteristics of their morphology related to long limbs and a short tail, which means they can never jump and they can't leap. And they also are relatively slow. So the fact they can't jump or leap means all their movements have to be on branches that are connected, because they're totally tree-dwelling animals. They only come out at night. They have huge eyes, large brains, and other characteristics which I could tell you about as we continue. But in general, the small nocturnal primates that live in South and Southeast Asia. And the reason they're called a loris, and something else important to their biology, is they all have wonderful facial masks. So they all have these beautiful diamonds around their eyes or patches in between their eyes or going down onto their chin and into their ears. And when they were first discovered by Dutch explorers in the 17th century, they called them the loris, which in Old Dutch means clown.
Ah.
Because of their facial mask.
So they can't leap or jump, unlike a squirrel, but they can swing from branch to branch? Or how do they move around in the trees?
Yeah, they can't swing either. They can hang from their hind legs. But in general, they move a bit like, it's almost serpentine, like a snake. They slither almost. I mean, they move their arms side to side. They can flex their arms in any direction. They usually have at least three legs connected to a branch. So they move their legs extremely rapidly, despite being relatively slow. And it's just a slithering, elegant movement. And in fact, when they're startled by predators or by humans, particularly humans with big white lights who try to look at them in the forest, they freeze, and they become even slower. They become extremely slow. So they are trying to evade being predated upon by what's called crypsis, being so slow and so quiet, they hope the predator won't see them. And this is also something interesting in their early biology back in the 17th century and 18th century. They were actually thought to be related to the South American sloth because they were so slow. And then they eventually realized they were primates.
Really? So, and does that strategy work, being so slow and quiet?
Well, I've been studying them now for 15 years. And I've seen some predators try to go for a loris. I've lost a couple of lorises, probably to predators, but they were babies that are even more helpless. And a colleague of mine has seen one eaten by a snake. But, and of course, a snake isn't a stealth predator, so being slow won't help you so much against a snake as it would against a raptor, an owl, or a small cat. So it seems that, in reality, their predators are relatively limited. But we don't have good data on it. But they are eaten, in fact, by orangutans. But that's when they're sleeping in the daytime, so they're pretty vulnerable when they're asleep. And if you and you can go up, and if you're very strong, you could just take them off a branch. So they have a strong grip, but you could easily pull them off a branch. So an orangutan in the daytime against the loris has very little chance.
And so is the orangutan the most likely predator, or are there a lot of others?
Well, the main predator really is humans. So, but I think we'll get to that more later.
Right.
there are other interesting strategies about lorises that seem to make predators not too keen to eat them. And the most exciting one is that the evidence is building more and more that lorises are not only one of the few toxic or poisonous or venomous animals in the world, they are the only venomous primates. And the fact that they have a form of biological venom, which either, well, it seems to be a combination that it is produced within their body, but it is also sequestered from things that they eat that are high in toxins, things like poisonous insects. They use that poison to potentially protect themselves and their offspring against predators.
So can you describe this poison and how they use it? Is it something that they secrete or only when they bite? Or
It's very strange. And we have a big project over the next year where we're going to try to work on it a bit more. And we only know about it basically from some tests on captive animals about the actual properties of the poison. But it comes from two parts of the loris. One thing that characterizes proscenians in general is that they have a wet nose like a cat or dog. So scent marking is very important for them, and much more important than it is for humans, monkeys, or apes. And most of the proscenians have sets of glands that exude a secretion that they use for scent marking and things. And in the loris, it's the brachial gland, which is a bit above the elbow. It's on their upper arm. And when they are attacked by a predator or faced with a danger, one of the first things they do is shove their arms above their head as tight as they can, and this protects the head, which is extremely vulnerable. And because they don't have a tail, their head looks a bit like their bottom, so they have a bit of a camouflage that way. So the predator can't really tell which is the front and which is the back. And as they're putting their arms above their head, you see them move their mouth from side to side, and they mix a substance from the brachial gland with their saliva. And then that saliva is in their mouth. And what we know from the captive studies is the compound that is created can kill mice. So if we take that saliva mixed with the brachial gland exudate, it can kill mice. It also is known, it's been presented to various predators like bears and felids, and they really don't like it. They may even run away from it. And we know that it can kill humans because a number of zookeepers have either become extremely sick or died, and there are some cases in the published literature where people die from loris bites. And if you want to go by traditional ecological knowledge in the possession of the local people who live in the forest side by side with the lorises, there are countless stories from them of how the loris bite will kill you. And when they're catching them for various reasons in the wild, they have mechanisms to make sure the loris doesn't bite them because they're very afraid of it. And what we also know from the lab results is there's a great similarity to the toxin to cat allergen, feline allergen. And so it forms in humans in particular an anaphylactic shock. And the more you come into contact with lorises, it actually can increase your allergy to it. So you may have been, say, a zookeeper for a few years and not been affected by the loris. And then 5 years on, you would have built up an intolerance, interestingly. And even after 5 years, you might still go into this anaphylactic shock from the loris bite.
Oh, really?
And I have a colleague who is exactly, she actually worked with them for about 10 years before she got the anaphylactic effect from the bites. And was in the hospital for 3 days.
Wow. And so you need to be bitten or just handling them? You
have to be bitten, and it has to have the saliva and the brachial gland exudate combined. So they have to have the chance to wipe their face against their elbow, basically. But they're really quick at that. It's amazing. The minute you go near them, their little arms shoot up, and then they start doing this gesture. And there's a lovely guy. He's one of my favorite authors. And I think when we look at authors from the past, they often weren't distracted by anything else in the world, and all they could do with their life was observe the natural world. And this author was called John Still, and he wrote in 1905, and he was in Sri Lanka. And he kept loads of animals as pets. He was a British civil servant, and he had his own menagerie. And he kept cobras, and he kept lorises. And he tells a wonderful story where he was in his office working in the night, and he heard the horrible sound of a cobra coming from the room where his loris was tethered to the top of its cage. And he went in with a baseball bat to kill the cobra, or some kind of implement, probably wasn't a cricket bat, maybe, to kill the cobra, or to strike it away from his loris. And instead, he saw a shadow on the wall with the long, thin body of the cobra with the hood raised above its head, swaying in the manner of the cobra. And as he turned from the shadow to the cobra itself, it was his loris standing tall on its hind legs with its arms raised above its head in the form of a cobra's hood, swaying its body and hissing at a cat, the house cat that had attacked it or was trying to attack it. So it's this amazing form of mimicry, and I've seen it. I've held a loris in my hand as it stood up, raised its arms like a hood, and spits in my face, hissing at me. And it's really incredible. So there's also potentially this really incredible form of mimicry of a predator to go along with this biological toxin.
Wow, that's really interesting. Is that present in any other animal like that?
A lot of animals imitate predators or imitate even, for example, cuckoos who lay their eggs in the nests of birds, so you have kind of parasite predators, and you have animals that have long-term evolved to look like something else, so they're not predated upon. But I haven't come across this incredible behavior of mimicry of a predator like the loris does.
Who would think that a loris could look like a cobra?
Especially for the slender loris. And the two types of loris is the slender loris and the slow loris. They're very different. In German, they're called the slender loris and the plump loris, which might be a better description. Because the slender loris has a body about the size of a large banana, and it looks like you've stuffed 4 pencils in it. And a colleague of mine, Alison Jolly, aptly described them as bananas on stilts. And that's what they look like. Whereas the slow loris, in fact, your viewers or your public may know what they look like if they've ever seen the original 3 Star Wars films. Or I guess it's the third one, Return of the... I don't know what it's called. There's an animal called an Ewok, at any rate, and the Ewoks were modeled after slow lorises.
Oh, were they really?
They're cute, cuddly little fluff balls, and they are plump. They're not as skinny. So I reckon the cobra imitation works better with the slender loris, although slow lorises do it quite a lot. But what's interesting, the difference is the slow loris smash their arms against their head, whereas the slender loris kind of puts them out to the side, so as and sort of the wrists are on top of the head, and they do that swaying motion. But the hiss is pretty impressive. It's a very scary hiss. They don't make many sounds, but when they come out with this hiss, it's really loud and really scary.
Really? Can you imitate it?
Well, they kind of go like that. I call it the Hoover noise or the vacuum cleaner.
What are the other differences between slender and slow lorises? So the slender lorises is more about the size of a large banana, you said?
Yeah. They never get above 300 grams, and on average, I'd say they're 250 grams. There are only two recognized species of slender loris, although there are probably more on their way. Two of them, well, one of them is found only in Sri Lanka, and the other species goes in, from Sri Lanka into India. And the one that's found only in Sri Lanka is the smallest. That's the one that's about 130 grams. And really, they're just so, they're so skinny, and they're pretty social. They live in groups of five or six animals. They can give birth to one animal, one baby or two. I suppose the biggest difference between a slow and slender loris is the slender lorises almost eat exclusively insect prey. So they're one of the few primates in the world that rely almost only on animal prey. They eat insects and small lizards and bats and small birds. And although they occasionally eat fruits and flowers and some gum, which is an exudate that comes out of tree wounds, they rely mainly on insects. Whereas the slow loris, because it's a bit larger, they probably couldn't survive on insects alone. So they supplement their diet with a huge number of these gums from the tree wounds, nectar from flowers, and a bit of fruit. But they seem to be extremely specialized for having any sort of an exudate from a tree, be it nectar, be it gum, be it sap. So so it's a dietary difference, and that physical difference of just being skinny versus a little bit plumper. But otherwise, they're very similar. They, when you watch their behavior, they do similar kind of things. I would say the slender loris is, well, one of them is very fast. There's one slow loris that can move very fast, but slender lorises have a bit smaller home ranges. Slow lorises, again, with their larger body size, they can have enormous home ranges for their body size. So the size of maybe 30 hectares, which is the size of about 30 football fields, and they're only 300 grams.
How does that compare to other animals?
That's pretty huge. If you look at a leaf-eating monkey, like a howler monkey, they can have a home range which is only 3.5 hectares, and they could have a whole group of 6 or 7 or even 10 howler monkeys, and a home range a tenth the size of a small pygmy slow loris.
And
so,
where are slow lorises found?
Okay, at the moment, there used to be two species of slow loris. As we study nocturnal primates, we start finding there are more and more species just because they were completely unstudied. We didn't even know how many species there were. And they range all the way from the northeast of India in states like Assam and Tripura. They go into Bangladesh. They go into Bhutan. And then they go out into Southeast Asia, into Myanmar, into southern China, Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, Malaysia, and Indonesia. I think that's all of them. Hope I'm not forgetting one. But they don't go into Sulawesi and they only go into the very western islands of the Philippines.
Now, you've been studying them, and I'm curious, are the lorises endangered?
Yes. So,
or don't we know, because we have no information?
Yeah, when I started studying them, they were all considered by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, which is IUCN, which generates categories of critically endangered, endangered, vulnerable, etc. They were all considered least concern or data deficient. This was partially A, because nobody knew how many there were left, and also because it wasn't known how many species there were. But also, really, nobody was documenting anything about their threats. And so once we started looking for them in the wild, your people always assumed they were there. If they would see one in a market or one as a pet, they would assume they were very abundant in the forest. And so when I actually, for my PhD, started to look for them in India, really, for the first time, even the Indian researchers didn't know a forest where I could find a loris. And we had to spend about 6 months just finding a forest where we could study slender lorises. I then went through the same procedure in Sri Lanka. And again, there was a single place in the entire island where people were sure there were slender lorises. And after that, I just went around the island from forest to forest looking for them, trying to find a good population or a population at all where we could study them. And now we're doing the same thing country by country in the rest of Southeast Asia. And I think I can say I'm the only person in the world who studied every single species of slow and slender loris in the wild now, which is quite exciting to have seen them all. There's still some countries I haven't been to yet, but And there's countries where I've been to where we haven't been able to find any, such as China, or China is the main one. But, yeah, so they when we do find them, what we do find is because it's a little tiny animal, has a very huge home range, they occur at extremely low population densities, but also because they are reliant on canopy continuity, which means branch touches branch, because they cannot leap, they can't cross paddy fields, they can't cross large open plains. It's difficult for them to even cross a road because they need canopy continuity to survive. So they're extremely affected by habitat fragmentation. They're extremely affected by trees being cut down in any sort of gaps in the canopy. And also, because they are cryptic and their strategy to protect themselves against predators is to freeze and curl up in a ball, they are the perfect candidates for being hunted. So if a hunter goes into the forest and he's looking for a tiger and he sees a loris, he goes, oh, great, that's easy. I could just catch that one as well. And they're not a target species. It's just, in some places there are target species, but they may, even if a hunter is not looking for them, he'll catch them as well, which is a really dangerous thing for their conservation. And so we're finding out now that all of these things are major threats, and there's no species now that is not vulnerable, endangered, or critically endangered.
Do we know how many exist in the wild, or no?
No, that's really difficult. For one or two of the species, we can make estimates of 500 or less, or 5,000 or less. Some of them, there's one that is still vulnerable because of these factors, but there are probably a couple hundred thousand of them, but because they actually have a range all the way from India into China. But there probably are also multiple species of that one, so once we're able to solve the species issue, they will be in far more trouble than we think they are at the moment. And the last thing I should say about lorises that characterizes both slender and slow lorises, which is also a characteristic of primates, is that amongst all the primates, because of their slow nature, it's also related to a very slow basal metabolic rate, and it's also related to slow reproductive output. So a little tiny slender loris, if we compare it to one of the lemurs of a similar body size, the lemur can have its babies after 3.5 months, which are reproducing after a year. A slender loris will take 6.5 to 7 months to have its babies, or one or two babies, and they may not reproduce until they're about 20 months old. And so in her life, a female loris probably in the wild lives to the age of about 16, maybe 20. She's not likely to have more than 5 or 10 offspring, which for an animal that small is a really slow reproductive rate. And because the babies are vulnerable to predation, all of those 10 aren't likely to survive. So this is another problem for them, is this very slow reproductive rate.
And so just by comparison, lemurs live how long and produce how many offspring over their life?
Yeah, so the one I'm thinking of is called the fat-tailed dwarf lemur, which is about the same size of a slow loris. And they will live to about the same age, but because they can have at least one or two babies a year, they're more likely to have 2 or 3 times the number of babies a loris would have.
When you're doing research, how do you even go about finding a loris? It seems like they'd be very difficult to find because, as you said, they're small, they have large home ranges, they're slow, so you can't rely on movement to turn your eye to them. How do you
find
them?
And they don't make hardly any sounds as well. this has been an interesting journey over the last 15 or 16 years because essentially, one thing that I do is I go to a museum, and say for the first time I'm going to a country, say the first time I went to Sri Lanka, I went to the museum or museum collections, various museum collections, where I knew there were a lot of slender lorises that had been collected 100 years ago or 200 years ago, and I look at all the locations where they were collected. So then I have a list of places I can go when I get to the country. I then speak to wildlife experts in the country, professors at universities, people who work for NGOs, and I ask, you know, is there any forest left at this place? And what happened in Sri Lanka, in fact, was there was hardly any forest left in that place, in the places where they had been collected. So, but there were similar forest types in other parts of the country. So you just end up then in that forest. And what I always do is I talk to local villagers and I ask if they've ever seen the animal. And very often they find some guy who's a logger or a hunter or who collects products in the forest, and he'll say, oh, I can take you in the forest, and you know, and I know the way around the forest. So the main things to do when you're looking for lorises is you need to go into the forest with a very small group of people, ideally two, because one isn't very safe. Ideally, you'd go with one, but in the forest at night, it's really great to have someone else in case something bad happens to you. The other very important thing is to walk very slowly, to walk quietly. Make sure your field guide doesn't smoke the whole time or talk on his mobile phone, which is common. And the best thing you could possibly do is get a really good halogen light with a red filter, because lorises can't see red, and they aren't really afraid of red lights, whereas a big white light they're afraid of. And the newfangled energy-efficient halogen light, LED lights, which are available at all the camping shops, degrade the retinas of mammals. So it's really horrible to go look at nocturnal animals at night with an LED light. And it's getting harder and harder to find any lights that aren't LED, which is a big problem for us as researchers.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't think that's well known.
Yeah, it's a bit of a problem. It is, if you did a search for it on the internet, where it is well known is for humans, because a lot of people were starting to heavily complain when they started to change the headlights of cars to LED. Because if you do have one of those cars behind you when you're driving at night, you realize how painful it is. That these blue, extremely bright lights. And so if you notice, modern cars don't have those lights anymore. Like, they were really prevalent around, say, 2005 to 2008. And then the studies came out that they were dangerous for the eyes, and now they're replacing them with something else. And it's not a lot of work has been done on it, but what I can tell you is when you look at an animal with an LED, it just closes its eyes as if it's in horrible pain, and it won't look at you. It turns away. It runs away. And also, if you're in the forest at night with a human, and one person has, say, the halogen light, and the other person has the LED light, and you did a little experiment, it completely blinds you, and it's extremely painful to be looked at with an LED. And our eyes aren't nearly as sensitive as a lorises, which can absorb huge amounts of light, because, in fact, they have one of the largest eyeballs of the primates. And yeah, and so it's not nice for them. So we use these animal-sensitive, friendly lights with a red filter, accompanied often with a night vision scope or a night vision camera, and therefore we can see them. And you do detect them by their eye shine, because they have huge, massive, round eyeballs that are very close together that emit a distinctive red glow, and you could tell them apart from other animals. And because they tend to move pretty slowly, they often look at you when you spot them. And if you look at them with the white light, they run away pretty quickly or they go very high. But with the red light, they just see this little two-legged thing walking down below in the trees, and they get really curious, and they often head cock at you and look at you really curiously before deciding to run away. And this is another reason they're really easy to hunt, because they're pretty curious and they don't see humans too much. So, and especially in the more remote places, they may have never seen a human at night in the forest. So even the babies, sometimes the babies will come down to eye level and just really look at you really sweet, and you could give them a cuddle.
And are they used as food, as a bushmeat?
Well, this is one of the biggest problems facing the slow lorises. The slender lorises, more in the past, well, particularly in Sri Lanka, they still seem to be used a bit more in India. They've been used for all sorts of traditional medicines and for I wouldn't want to call it magic, but you could say traditional ethnographic practices, things like casting bad luck on your neighbor, cursing the building of your neighbor's new house, bringing bad luck from the servants, you know, these sort of things. You could use different body parts of lorises. And so we still see that to a certain extent in Sri Lanka, in India, but where it's extremely prevalent is in Indochina. Throughout Indochina, especially in Myanmar, in Laos, in Vietnam, in Cambodia, in China itself, you get a dramatic use of lorises in traditional medicines. Although we know that they're used in the various countries, and we've got accounts of this use, the first major study of their use in traditional medicines was in fact just published, and that was mainly the work of my PhD student, Carly Starr, who's based at the University of Queensland in Australia. And she lived in Cambodia for about 4 years. She learned the local language, and she worked with traditional medicine practitioners all around the country. And she worked with students from the University of Phnom Penh, and they were able to collect a huge data set regarding the use of these animals in traditional medicines. And they are called the animal with 100 uses, and they're considered essentially in Cambodia, and I know the practice is very similar in Vietnam and Laos in particular, they're kind of considered an aspirin. You know, any kind of ache or pain, oh, we'll have some loris. And this is a real problem for that, for the species in that area.
So what are some of those 100 uses? How is the animal used?
The possibly what seems to be the most important use is to alleviate the pain of after giving childbirth. So if a woman has given childbirth, she will order a tonic of a loris, usually of two or three lorises, and then she drinks that tonic to alleviate pain. And the amount, and the lorises are steeped and boiled in rice wine. And rice wine tends to come in about, a pottery jug kind of thing of about 2 liters. And that 2 liters might last a week or so for the medicinal purposes. And then she might need to make another batch of it. And essentially, when the lorises are killed, they are killed in two different ways.
Just as a warning to listeners, the next 2.5 minutes is quite graphic.
Sometimes they're beaten to death on sight because of this toxic bite, and people are afraid of them. They knock them out of the tree, or they catch them from the tree. They stomp on them, and they beat them to death, usually with a stick. Because they're pretty slow and they can't move well on the ground, once you give them one bash with a stick, it's they get a little bit clumsy, so you could bludgeon them and bash them over and over. And it's a really painful death because I don't know why. It's really horrific because they can take a very long time to kill. And they suggest in Cambodia as well that they have magical properties because when you knock them out of a tree, they can climb right back up the tree. So they say if their legs break, because they assume if you fall that far out of a tree, your legs probably break, that they must be magical because they climb straight back up. And I don't really know how they can fall so far out of the tree without breaking their limbs, but it's probably a bit like a cat. But they could fall probably about 5 or 6 or 7 meters out of a tree and be able to climb straight back up.
Really?
It's amazing. And so if you don't kill a loris that way, straight away, when you're in the forest, they also sometimes believe that depending on the use of the loris, it will have more properties if you kill it alive, so if you prepare it alive. And how they prepare it is they either saw the animal in half, starting down its forehead, down the center of its nose, down its entire body. And then they put bamboo skewers to spread the body out flat, kind of like a pancake, and they dry it over the flame. Or they shove a bamboo stick up its rectum, out its mouth, and then they suspend it over the fire and they smoke it that way. And that's normally how they smoke them alive. So it's a really horrific, painful death. And then these animals are smoked, and once they're dried, they last quite a long time. And those people who have visited Laos or Vietnam or Myanmar, an extremely common sight in any of the roadside stalls where you can buy animals are these animals stretched out on bamboo skewers. And I get asked about them all the time, what they're for. It's been, you know, people think that they're to ward off bad luck or something. The tourists will think this. But in fact, once you have that dried loris, you can do all sorts of things with it. You could boil the whole thing. You could take parts of it. You can grind up its bones. And people make loris pastes. They make make little talismans out of them, all sorts of things.
So really, one loris can fulfill a lot of different purposes.
It can, unless they do one of the treatments where they use the whole body.
Is it used very often in traditional medicine? Is it sort of the go-to medicine, or is it more rare?
I would say in Cambodia, it's the most common traditional medicine. It's more common than any other animal. Another very popular one is pangolins. So pangolins have a lot of uses in traditional medicine, which pangolins are small, armored animals, kind of like an armadillo or an anteater. So you do see those.
Do pangolins have the same properties as loris as far as, you know, being viewed as sort of like an aspirin?
Not quite. They have more specific uses. So they're used for pain, or they're used for asthma, or they're used for sexually transmitted diseases is a pretty common one. It's essentially, we do rely on a lot of pharmaceuticals that are derived from natural products in the West. So I think as well, in amongst the lorises, or amongst actually, sorry, any of these animal products in Southeast Asia or in Indochina, they rely on those like we rely on our pharmaceuticals. And so you could find an animal that will cure almost anything. Or cure broken bones is a good one for lorises because they have this thing where they fall out of the tree and heal their bones. So they use it for broken bones a lot too. But for other animals, yeah, they all have their uses. There's lists of all the things these animals are used for and how they're used as well. So the bone or the flesh or a paste made from them or mixing them with a tonic, all of these things.
For lorises, does it work? Is there a medicinal property that's been found, or no one knows really yet?
Yeah, nobody knows really yet. Obviously, people believe they work. And they believe they work so strongly. You think these things are restricted to the poor villagers who don't know, you know, who are ignorant of Western medicine. But in fact, in Cambodia, the biggest users of loris medicines are the wealthy people in Phnom Penh. Because often the poor people, they can't afford it. Or they can get it from the forest, but it's worth much more money to them if they could sell it to wealthy people in Phnom Penh. So even the very educated people who have access to Western medicine still use it. And what we were hoping to do ultimately in our research project is to try to test the medicinal properties of the lorises. And just like they've done for tiger bone, they found, for example, that tiger bone does have a medicinal quality, but it can easily be reproduced with a simple medicine. And so, but people still don't want to use it, even if the other medicine is made available. And so we're a little bit worried we might face the same problem with lorises, is if we do find that it works, people still won't want to use it.
If someone were to catch one and sell one for medicinal purposes, do they get a lot of money or no?
Well, in local terms, they can get a lot of money. It may start at $5, and it, as they go from a village to the middleman, they can fetch up to $100, $150. And that's lorises for medicine. For pets, they probably fetch a bit more than that. And we don't know much what happens where you have communities of people living abroad. So say, if you have a Vietnamese community living abroad, and if they try to get the loris, say, coming into a place like North America, there's very little data about how much the prices fetch once it gets to that level for medicines. Because also, obviously, it may not look like a loris once it gets there. It may be in a tonic or a paste, so you don't even know that there's a loris in it. With the pets, it's a little bit easier to trace how much they're worth. And the pet trade is another thing that we may get onto in a minute. But a loris pet can reach up to $15,000 for one loris.
Now, do they make good pets? Because I wouldn't want to get bitten by one.
the other problem we have with lorises, which is more of a problem in Indonesia, is that they are sold very heavily into the pet trade. And I say Indonesia, but that's not quite true, because one of the most popular lorises in pets is pygmy lorises. And pygmy lorises are found, they're one of the species found in Indochina. And it seems a lot of the lorises going into the pet trade are coming out of Cambodia and Thailand and Vietnam, or from Cambodia, Thailand, and Vietnam via Singapore. So we do get a lot of those animals into the pet trade. But where the open pet markets are the most obvious are in Indonesia. And in Indonesia, we have three very large islands, Borneo, Sumatra, and Java. And the main problems seem to be in Sumatra and Java, where we have two distinct species. And because, again, traders suspect or know or whatever that the loris is a toxic bite, what they do is they rip out their teeth. And they rip out their teeth without any anesthesia. They may rip them out with pliers. They cut them out with toenail clippers. And this is on a very dirty, unhygienic street in the middle of a bird market with lots of pollution. And it's just it could be adult ones or young ones, and you see the loris kind of crying in pain as its teeth are being clipped out. And because very often they don't do a very good job of it, the roots are left in the jaw, and this causes disease and an inflammation of the jaw, which can lead to an abscess, which leads to brain death. It also is a number one cause of pneumonia, because pneumonial infection gets into those wounds. And so if they're lucky enough to survive getting their teeth ripped out, then they have to survive, you know, living in this pet market before someone buys them. And it's a really horrific trade. If they are confiscated and tried to be released to the wild, I mentioned earlier that they eat a lot of gums from trees. And in order to eat gums, you need your teeth to gouge a hole in the tree. And so you can't do anything with these lorises without teeth. They may as well have died in the market or be euthanized. It's really sad. And there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these animals. And also it's very difficult for them to eat. They can't groom each other. They have a special set of teeth in the front of their mouth that's called a tooth comb. And they use it to groom each other. And so they lose their main social attachment with each other. They lose their ability to forage naturally in the wilds. And more often than not, they die. And so these people who want lorises as a pet, it's really heartbreaking. So even if they can't bite you because they don't have a tooth comb anymore, they still don't make good pets. I mean, they are, I have to say, they are sweet animals. They are remarkably friendly for wild animals. But they are poisonous. And they also love to pee. They urinate all over your house if you have one as a pet. And they really, really smell terrible. It's disgusting. And so that's another great reason not to have one as a pet.
But they're still treasured.
Yeah, they're very cute. And unfortunately, there was a horrific video that was on YouTube last year, and it was voted the number one animal video of the year. It got several million hits. It got linked to several other sites, like cuteness.com or whatever. And it was a couple in Russia who had a pygmy slow loris as a pet. And they were grooming it, and they were tickling it, and it kept looking at the camera with this really cute face. And this massive debate went on with people trying to say these animals are illegal as pets. And we researched the origin of the animal because the people said, oh, but it's legal to keep primates that are captive bred in Russia as pets. But there's never been a single case of a pygmy slow loris being imported legally into Russia for the pet trade. So even if two people illegally imported the parents and then they sell the baby as captive bred, the parents were still illegal, which makes the baby illegal, which means any pygmy loris in Russia is illegal. And so they had a big website trying to explain why their loris was legal, and it was really obese, it was really sick, it had alopecia, it was losing its hair. So if you knew anything about the loris, and they also called it the wrong species as well, but so if you knew anything about it, it was absolutely horrific. And most of the people, because we actually quantified the comments, several thousand comments, most of the people were, oh, it's so cute, where can I buy one? Oh, it's so cute, where can I get one? And we thought it was just awful, because on YouTube, if you had child pornography, on YouTube, if you had people doing drugs, it would immediately be reported and shown as illegal. But having a pet that is illegal, that has been imported illegally, you know, into the wildlife trade, they overlook this because it's cute. And this is the whole problem with, I think, the illegal pet trade in general, is it's so confounded in these laws and how you can get an animal illegally into a country and then breed from it. So how do you prove if it's illegal or not, eventually, if it's been a few generations in captivity? So that was something that I think took us 10 steps back in the fight from trying to keep Westerners having lorises as pets, because it really inspired a whole new generation to want one.
Has that video now been taken off?
Nope, it's still one of the most popular ones. It's all over. You can find it anywhere on the internet. It's everywhere. And even if it was taken off YouTube, it's been attached to so many other sites. It would be like fighting a losing battle trying to get rid of it.
Let's turn to your research a little bit, because I know you've done a lot of research recently that was just paper just released on lorises in the traditional medicine trade. And what did that research involve?
That research was conducted with three other colleagues as well. And all of us, I had worked in Sri Lanka since 2001. My colleague Vincent Nyman, he'd worked in Indonesia since the early 1990s. Carly Starr had worked in Cambodia since about 2004, and Chris Shepherd had worked in Indonesia and Cambodia also since the 90s, and I'd also conducted work in Cambodia and Indonesia. And so what the study was comparing was what I've just told you now is, you know, lorises face threats. They face the pet trade and the medicinal trade. And what very often you might hear is that this is a problem that all lorises face. But if you work in a country and you live in a country and you almost become an anthropologist and you work side by side with local people and see how they're using the lorises, we find that they don't use them exactly the same in different countries. So, for example, in Laos, you're more likely to be able to buy a loris alive in a market to be used for medicine, whereas in Cambodia, it would almost always already be processed and dead. So that's a slight difference, especially for their conservation, that maybe you're more likely to be able to help and rehabilitate the Laotian ones than the ones in Cambodia. If you have no hope, obviously they're already dead. But and then you would have to go on from that to deal with practices for helping to perhaps change the views and practices of local people for the conservation of a species. So what we did, we did something called an ethnoprimatological approach or an ethnozoological approach, which is using ethnographic information to quantify the differences across cultures and how animals are used. And so therefore, say you're, whatever the species is, say it's a loris, say it's a pangolin, say it's a tiger, if you have an NGO who wants to produce education materials for Southeast Asia about why you shouldn't use tiger bone, why you shouldn't use lorises, why you shouldn't use pangolins, they might find, if you actually looked culture by culture, which makes perfect sense, but for some reason isn't normally applied in these education projects, that you have to do it not only even culture by culture, but within country, because you have major ethnographic differences within the country of how they use the animals. And you also have different views within the countries. For example, in Sri Lanka, the Sinhalese tended to think lorises were really beautiful or really innocent, whereas the Tamils often described them as very ugly. And they had derogatory terms within the Tamil language calling really skinny, skeletally ugly people a loris. Whereas in Sinhalese, you know, they had very interesting proverbs about them that had more to do with their medicinal uses. So you see the difference even within a country, and this will impact how we do conservation practice.
Interesting. And so what did you find? What were some of the major findings, and how can that be used in conservation?
I think one of the findings was for the slender loris, you don't really have an export trade. You do get people who have them as pets. You do have people who use them on an individual basis as medicine, but it's not a huge monetary trade where they're exporting them out of the country. We found very little evidence of that. Whereas in Indonesia, there's a lot bigger evidence that there's a trade for export. And the trade goes from Indonesia to other countries, so they might be using another country as a stepping stone to export those animals. And obviously, once there's international export, one of the greatest motivations for a government potentially to put their foot down on the export is by taxing the exporters. Because if it's illegal, the government doesn't see any money from it. Because very often these things only have a financial value to anyone who wants to have anything to do with protecting them. And so if you said, well, you have this massive wildlife trade in Indonesia, it's not only lorises, it's everything. It's birds, it's reptiles, it's other mammals, it's fish for exotic aquaria, etc. And so if you said to the government, well, if you legalized wild animal trade properly, then you could tax the exporters, and you'll suddenly make huge amounts of money, more money. The international wildlife trade is estimated to make more money than the drug trade, which I'm sure your listeners are familiar with. And so to actually regulate it is only to the advantage of the government. Whereas in Cambodia, again, you do get some level of export, but a lot of it is only export from the villages to the city. So it's not necessarily going international. It may mainly be national, although there is a lot of evidence of trade going to China as well. But, you know, and then so maybe you'd say, well, in one part of the country, we've got to monitor the borders to China, whereas we've also got to really see what's happening in the capital and try to do. So, for example, if we've got wealthy urban dwellers in Cambodia using loris medicines, one of the things we plan to do is send out a series of television adverts, because all of those people are very likely to have televisions. And when they see something on television, it has a powerful message because it's a relatively new medium for them for getting information. And so that was a plan we had to potentially help Lorises in that regard. So that's the main thing. And also the fact that a pet trade in Indochina is extremely limited. You don't really get a pet trade at all. Every now and then a person may have a loris as a pet, but it's extremely rare. Whereas in Indonesia, you still get some medicinal uses as well, but the pet trade is a major threat. So if we were going to say, what is the threat to Pygmaeus and Bengalensis, the Bengal and the Pygmy loris, which live in Indochina, they would have the threat of medicine, whereas if you had Javan slow loris, Bornean slow loris, or the Sumatran slow loris, their threat is going to be far more this pet trade. So, and actually in Borneo, you get more of the stories of lorises being used for their power or as a tonic for a drink. And I guess also in Borneo, you have a lot more traditional uses of lorises still that maybe were lost in Java, because Java is the most urbanized of the islands of Indonesia, for example. So all of that needs to be considered. And I think it makes very common sense. So we have to consider anthropological and ethnographic practices and conservation. But for an animal that maybe most of your listeners haven't heard of before, that most people in the world don't care about, and who most people aren't even willing to believe there are multiple species. They think, oh, it's just a stupid nocturnal animal. I don't care if it has a different genetic code and a different number of chromosomes. It's got to be the same species. Because they don't want to have to face the problem. So, it's important to consider these differences.
So, if people are interested in lorises, where can they go for more information?
Well, for many years, with a colleague from a university in Germany, we've been developing a loris and potto conservation database, and that's that website is, I think it's lorisconservation.org, so it's very easy to find it. And it's got information about all the species, about research that's been done on them, about how to identify them, about why you shouldn't keep them as pets, about what you should do if you're traveling in a foreign country and you come across one at a market. Because it's actually never a good idea to buy a loris, because once you buy it as a well-meaning tourist because you want to save it, it just means that the seller thinks, oh, wow, that's great. Tourists want to buy them, and it almost puts a higher value on them, and they want every loris you buy will be replaced anyway. But this never message never really goes through, and people always still buy these lorises and want to save them. But we have a list of the rescue centers for where you can deposit a rescued loris in any of the countries in their range. And we have information, too. For example, lorises are dressed up in clothes and walked around on the streets of the various Thai islands where people go for their holidays, like Phuket or Khao Samui. And we urge people not to take photographs with any of the primates that are dressed as pets. You also see macaques and gibbons. And, you know, just to try not to promote this trade in these animals. And that information is on there, too. So, I mean, that's a great place as a starting point, really. And there are a few other resources, but that's the big one, yeah.
So lorisconservation.org is a good place to start.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me.
Yeah, and thank you for trying to highlight the plight of these very little-known primates, because, like we said at the beginning, you know, they are really facing a dramatic, conservation crisis at the moment, and so few people know about it, and it would be sad to see them go extinct before anyone even knows what they are.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Anna Nakaris, an expert on Asia's slow and slender lorises. Now, let me play you today's creature call once again and see if you've guessed it correctly. This week's creature call is the sound of a nocturnal primate. It also was one of the topics of today's show. Have you guessed it yet? It's the sound of a slender loris. This sound is a growl and fear cry that's used as a defensive threat against predators. Its loudness varies depending on the intensity of the fear, and the growl may suddenly turn to long, loud screaming, like the screams of a cat. Listen to one of the sounds of a slender loris. Yeah. archived episodes of The Wildlife are available on iTunes, at my website, laurelnemi.com, and at laurelnemi.podbean.com. You can stream The Wildlife live at theradiator.org every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And, of course, if you have comments about this show or ideas for future ones, you can email me at laurel@laurelnemi.com.
The Wildlife is generously underwritten by the Lake Champlain Land Trust, a nonprofit organization permanently conserving the lands, lakeshore, critical wildlife habitats, and natural areas of Lake Champlain. More information is available online at lclt.org. This has been The Wildlife. I'm your host, Laurel Nemi, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington, Vermont.